It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 2020 presidential campaign has begun, and since the inception of the modern primary system, there have never been as many Democratic candidates in the field.
That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
To announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
I'm running for President of the United States of America.
I am a candidate for President of the United States of America.
Well, I'm going to run for President of the United States.
I am a candidate for President of the United States of America.
At last count, it was 22, but the day is yet young. Why are Democrats entering in droves? Is this reminiscent of what happened in the Wisconsin gubernatorial race last year? We thought it best to pose these questions to Howard Schwaber. He's a political science and legal studies professor at the UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, happy to be here.
So how usual or unusual is it to see such a high number of Democratic candidates running in this presidential election?
Oh, it's extremely unusual, particularly this early. I can't think of a year. There have been lots of years which either on the Republican side or the Democratic side, there have been a large number of candidates. But I can't recall ever seeing anything like this.
All right. So what is going on? Why are so many candidates getting into this race?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is no one thought it was possible early on that Donald Trump would ever become president. And among various other messages that his victory has sent, one of them is, good Lord, if this guy can win, maybe anybody can win. But beyond that, I think the important thing is that the Democratic Party doesn't have a unified identity at the moment. There are at least three different basic kind of mindsets. One is adversarial, run for president just to run against Donald Trump and everything that he stands for and to undo his effects. The second might be called aspirational. If our candidate couldn't beat Donald Trump, and we didn't, you know, there hasn't been quite the massive blue wave we hoped for, maybe it's because our party is too stodgy and too establishment, and what's needed is bold visions. And a lot of the candidates running are running on bold visions. The press describes this as a move to the left. I think of it more in terms of a move toward large-scale programs, large-scale government action. In some cases, describing this as a move to the left is not really accurate. And the third message, which I think Joe Biden is the obvious example, is kind of a message of restoration, bringing things back to normal. It's nostalgic. It's, you know, let's make the last few years go away and go back to the nicer way things were a few years ago.
What about money? There's a lot more money and donors involved in presidential elections. How does fundraising play a role in who runs and who doesn't?
Well, it's enormously important, obviously. One thing that has changed is that it's much easier to contribute both anonymously. I mean, due to various court opinions and FEC rulings, it's very easy to donate money anonymously. It's very easy to donate money to elude any limits that might be applicable. So the money is flowing very, very, very freely. It's also the case that the donor base has the same reactions as these candidates. Something has gone terribly wrong, but there is no agreement as to what the response is. And so different donors are funneling money in different directions as a result. And the third thing is that the electorate is just really very mobilized, and both large donations and small donations are coming in very large amounts. There's already a lot of money in play compared to previous election cycles. So that's just a sign of a very high level of energy and engagement.
We're talking about record number of Democrats on the presidential campaign trail and what to make of it with Howard Schwaber. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. You can join in 800-642-1234. What do you make of the Democratic field? Is the party net cast too wide, or do you like seeing so many options? You can call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Howard, can you draw any parallels here to the record number of Democratic gubernatorial candidates that we saw run in Wisconsin's partisan primaries last year?
Oh, I think you can. I mean, I think, once again, Wisconsin is a bit of a microcosm for the country at large. And I mean that in a couple of ways. First of all, in the way we've been talking about, there's a strong sense in Wisconsin among Democrats and liberal-leaning voters, oh my gosh, Governor Walker is awful, Act 10 was awful, various things that have happened is awful. Why is it we have not been able to retake control of all the branches of government? And of course, there are various answers to that question, but in the public mind, at least one of the answers is it must be that we're not doing it right. And so that opens the door for lots of candidates to offer their solutions to whether the Democratic Party should be more adversarial or more aspirational, you know, or more restorative, to use the terms I mentioned earlier. That's part of it. It's also the case, and we saw this especially in the last Supreme Court election, that conservative voters are very mobilized. Democratic energy once again failed to translate into turnout in this very critical judicial election. And there's a reason for that. And one reason for that is that on the conservative side, courts and cultural issues are absolutely central and extraordinarily salient. I always come back to one piece of data, which is that in 2016, among Trump voters, 25% of Trump voters said that retaking control of the courts was the number one reason for their decision on which candidate to vote for. On the Democratic side, among Clinton voters, that issue didn't break into the top five. And we saw that in the election here, the state Supreme Court election again, which was extraordinarily important for the future of the state. In the context of the Gorsuch and Kavanaugh nominations, you might have thought would have been a highly mobilizing issue. There were all sorts of reasons to expect massive Democratic turnout, and it didn't work. Even with a conservative candidate who takes very strong and controversial positions against LGBTQ equality, nonetheless, that didn't mobilize voters. And that feeds the perception that the Democratic Party is simply not being very effective.
Howard, let's pause right here and take Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So you got the former VP Biden jumping into the race. He seems to be the last one to throw his hat in. And it kind of makes a person who watches this stuff closely think, are we having a repeat here from the 2016 election with Hillary and the superdelegates pretty much already that was in her pocket is going to be jumping into Biden's pocket. He's polled number one so far next to above Sanders. So it's just fascinating. It almost seems like it's a repeat of the 2016 election and how that's going to play out with the younger voters of the Democrat Party looking at this as like, you know, here we go again.
Jeremy, let's get some insights here from Howard as we're running slightly short on time. What do you think?
I think it's much too early to say that. I don't expect it to play out that way for lots of reasons. Unless we get to the point which would be similar to the point we were at in 2016. If this comes down to Biden versus Sanders or Biden versus some other candidate who's viewed as unelectable in a national election, that will motivate superdelegates to flock to Biden. But that's the perception that drove those people, and I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. But yeah, it's possible that scenario could play out again. I think that would be very unfortunate.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, what are you watching for as this plays out and as these Democrats stump across the country, especially here in the battleground of Wisconsin?
Well, one thing I'm watching for that we're already seeing is the danger of too large a field. And the danger of too large a field is that in order to make space for yourself, you have to cut down the other candidates. And the evisceration that candidates can do to each other in the primaries can leave them weakened in the general election. That doesn't have to happen, but there are already signs that it might be. That is, there are already things happening in which some Democratic candidates are providing ammunition for Trump to use in the general election. If that happens on a large scale, the party will be considerably weakened.
Howard, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about why the Democratic primary is overflowing with candidates. Coming up, spring allergies are in full swing. We have an allergist joining us to discuss why it seems like more people suffer from allergies. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Allergy season is upon us. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pollen is an allergy trigger for 1 in 5 Americans. It comes back year after year and with a vengeance in the face of a warming climate. A recent study found that airborne pollen counts have been increasing around the world as average temperatures rise. And the study found an increase in the amount of pollen and longer pollen seasons over 2 decades. allergy sufferers and parents of allergy sufferers, let's hear from you. Have you noticed your allergies getting worse over time? Or maybe you're lucky they got better. What factors do you think contributed to that? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Gary Stephen is an allergist and immunologist at the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. Dr. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
No, thank you, Kate. Good morning.
Well, are we just more aware of allergies today, or are there more people out there suffering from allergies?
Well, that's a really complicated thing. Both of those are true. The incidence of allergies, especially food allergies, is increasing. Pollen levels are increasing. A long time ago, there were originally some studies done showing that when you grow plants in warmer temperatures, each plant will produce more pollen. You know, we've seen that here in the Milwaukee area. We do the pollen counts for southeastern Wisconsin, and I have seen an increase in tree pollen and mold counts, especially over the last 20 years since we started counting in 1995. The tree pollen and mold levels are actually about double what they were 20 years ago. And so there are more allergens out there. There are more people becoming allergic. There are more people, complaining about their allergies. To some extent, people just aren't taking it anymore. They're seeking care, for these symptoms that are being intolerable rather than just putting up with them.
So, what's the difference between seasonal allergies and year-round allergies?
Immunologically, it's the same, but when we speak of seasonal allergies, we're talking about reactivity to pollen, so the tree, grass, and weed pollens. Sometimes we speak of mold pollens as a seasonal allergen. That is something that's outdoors, particularly in the latter half of the summer. But year-round or perennial allergies are to indoor allergens such as dust mites, animal dander, and cockroach are the major indoor allergens. And of course, there's some overlap with mold. If there's mold contamination in a home, mold can serve as a year-round allergen. But the immunology is the same. The symptoms are the same. What's going on in the body is the same. You treat it the same. It's just a matter of what is the trigger.
Wait, I'm stuck on cockroach allergies. You can have allergies to cockroaches?
No, cockroach is a huge allergen. It's responsible for a great deal of severe asthma. And it is generally not a hidden allergen. We do find a lot of people have become sensitized to cockroach due to exposure in schools or in old buildings in which they work. But cockroach allergy is typically important to symptoms only if there is a cockroach infestation in the home.
What about hay fever? Where are we at with hay fever? And help us understand what it is.
Hay fever is seasonal allergic rhinitis. It's the more technical term for it. Hay fever is generally thought of as being allergic to ragweed pollen, because ragweed is the major weed allergen, and it pollinates during the time of the hay harvest in the fall, in August and September. So that's just a colloquial term for seasonal allergic rhinitis due to ragweed.
Talking with Dr. Gary Stephen, he's an allergist and immunologist at the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. Have you noticed your allergies getting worse over time? What factors contributed to that? Have you always had seasonal allergies or perhaps food allergies? How do you deal with them? We're at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Stephen, what is the connection between global warming and more people feeling seasonal allergies?
And that then refers to what I was talking about earlier, you know, just with the increase in pollen levels. There isn't that much of an effect on humans. You know, people live in a variety of climates. It's just getting a little warmer. It is more the production of pollen by plants is increasing as the temperatures increase. The plants grow better.
And what about mold? Have we seen an influx of mold?
Yeah, I have not seen any changes in the species, but the mold counts have gone up. Mold likes warm and damp. And so we've always seen an increase in mold counts right after a rain, with the increase in humidity and moisture. And we also see it increasing in towards the end of summer when it is warmer, as long as it's warm and damp. You know, if we get hit with a drought for a few weeks, the mold counts will drop a bit, even though it's warm. But if it's warm and damp, the mold counts are usually pretty significant.
And why might someone who hasn't had allergies before or hasn't really felt allergy symptoms before develop them as an adult with increased pollen counts?
That can happen. It is not terribly common.
Mm-hmm.
The development of allergies is usually associated with the big changes in hormones. So the vast majority of people who develop allergies do so before age 20. The commonly accepted figure for that is about 80% of allergic people will have developed their allergies before age 20. We do see that the allergic sensitivities change, either increasing or decreasing for the fortunate ones, with the hormone changes of pregnancy. We sometimes see it with the hormone changes of menopause. But males can develop allergies as an adult as well. It's like I say, it's less common, but it can occur. And some of it is just a matter of interpretation. People will have milder symptoms that they have tolerated all their life, and they're getting older, and they just decide to not tolerate it as much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most common thing that's going on when people say that their antihistamines no longer work, because that's not really true. Antihistamines work, period. They block the action of histamine when it gets released in an allergic reaction. But you can see your allergies become more and more severe so that the antihistamines are no longer sufficient. But to the patient, it seems like it doesn't work anymore. But no, they're actually just more allergic, and their antihistamines are no longer sufficient.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Mary Kay joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I've been with people that have severe allergies. And the number one thing to do is to get, like, your pillowcases covered, the non-allergic ones or pillows. You have to have a clean air machine in your home. And you cannot smoke.
Mary Kay, thanks.
And the cockroach. And about the cockroaches, I totally agree. You cannot have rodents or cockroaches or anything like that.
Thank you, Mary Kay. So it sounds like she's really stressing having those clean air and certainly clean sheets.
Well, I do caution people about that. I call that the magazine approach to allergy, because you read in magazines about all of these things you can do to reduce your exposure to allergens. But the important thing in my mind is making a diagnosis. And that's what I don't like about these big articles about allergen reduction, is that they never seem to mention going to an allergist to get your allergies diagnosed. And all of the allergen avoidance measures in the world are not going to make any difference if you're not reducing your exposure to the allergens that are important to you. And the main thing that we see, from what the issue that she brought up with the allergy covers on the pillows and mattress, those are the best way to reduce your exposure to dust mite allergen. But if you're allergic to the pets that are in the home or the cockroach, if there's a cockroach problem in the home, the allergy covers aren't going to do you any good because that is not what's driving your symptoms. And so I always stress that people see an allergist, and the allergists don't need to be constantly seeing people over long periods of time. You need to get an allergy evaluation from an allergist, allow the allergist to make recommendations back to the primary care physician.
And we have to pause right there with Dr. Gary Steven from the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you always had seasonal allergies or food allergies? How do you deal with them? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this after a news update on the Ideas Network. Spring allergies are upon us. We're talking about why this season will be worse than recent years. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Most seasonal spring allergies are caused by tree pollen as the trees start to bud, grow new leaves. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 50 million people in our country suffer from allergies and hay fever. Are you one of them? What are your questions about seasonal allergies or food allergies, allergy diagnosis, medication? We're with allergist Gary Steven, and he stays with us for this conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now with Mark joining us from Sheboygan. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I'll just tell you my quick story. When I was in my late 30s, early 40s, I had really bad allergies. I was on prescription meds, and it was basically all caused by tree pollen, according to the clinical tests. At the same time, I was morbidly obese, and I underwent gastric bypass surgery. And shortly thereafter, which turned out to be a very positive thing, by the way, otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you right now, I became vegetarian because of the issues of digesting meat with a smaller digestive system. My allergies just, they're gone. They went away. I am not sure why. Could be unrelated, but they're gone. And I take nothing now, so... That's my story.
Mark, thanks for calling in. What might diet have to do with allergies, Dr. Steven?
It's possible that his diet had something to do with it, but it is much more likely the fact that he lost all of the weight. That has been a very interesting area of research over the last 10, 15 years in the area of allergy and asthma especially. And we've known for a long, long time that people that are significantly overweight have much harder to control asthma. And obviously the initial impression was that, well, yeah, it's harder to breathe. You got more weight that you're lugging around. But there have been a lot of really good evidence showing that obesity is a pro-inflammatory condition. It is not simply a matter of lugging around a lot of extra weight. And so people who are significantly obese, just the obesity itself makes any other inflammatory condition they have much, much worse. And so I think that it was most likely the fact that he lost the weight that did the most good, not the change in diet.
Well, let's take another call now. Let's go to Scott joining us from Holman. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind about allergies?
Well, I've had seasonal allergies my whole life. Dust, molds, pollens, ragweed's a huge one. I went to an allergy specialist in La Crosse, and they recommended these allergy drops, sublingual drops. They're very expensive and weren't covered by my insurance, so I didn't do them. I was just curious as to what your opinion on these sublingual drops is, or if you have an opinion.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, the drops do work. They're used in other countries around the world and have been for decades. The studies that were done, you know, in the United States, you know, confirmed that they work. The dose is very high, and to get a truly effective dose, you're using your 1 to 3,000 times more allergen than what is administered with the injections, and that is one of the reasons why it has been difficult to get FDA approval. We do have 3 tablets for use under the tongue on the market in the United States for grass, ragweed, and dust mites. The tablets are easier to produce. There's better quality control. There are fewer issues with shipping the material. And so the FDA was more interested in approving tablets than the drops. But yeah, the drops do work when they are used correctly and when they are used at a high enough dose. It's just that without FDA approval and without insurance coverage, treating with an effective dose to the drops is prohibitively expensive for most people.
Karam from Kenosha called in to ask, how many times should people go to an allergist? He went when he was 25, wasn't diagnosed then, but he says now at age 43, he does have allergies. So can it change over someone's life? And when should he check in?
It certainly can. You change over your life. There are 3 main things that you're trying to do with treating allergies. Obviously, creating seasonal allergies. Obviously, the first is symptom control. You want to be comfortable. Number 2, it is important to be breathing through the nose at night. The saliva has an important antibacterial effect in the mouth, but only when it is wet. And so allergy sufferers who have considerable congestion, they cannot breathe through the nose when they're sleeping. They're breathing through their mouth. They're drying out the mouth. They're losing the antibacterial effect of saliva. And they're at greater risk of tooth disease and gum disease. And we already go to the dentist more often than we want to without asking for more. And number 3 is uncontrolled allergic inflammation in the nose and sinuses. It predisposes people for sinus infections. And pretty much everybody is welcome to have a sinus infection every year or so, just due to, you know, viruses and things like that. But if you're getting antibiotics for sinus infections 2, 3, or more times per year, that's a good indication that there's an unacceptable level of allergic inflammation in the nose and sinuses that is leading to all of these infections. And you need to see somebody who can help you out with that. So if you're self-treating using over-the-counter medications, if your symptoms are adequately controlled, you're reasonably comfortable, you're happy with that. If your nose is open enough that you're breathing through your nose at night, not drying out the mouth, and you're not getting multiple sinus infections per year, then you're doing well. And if not, then see an allergist.
We're talking about allergy season with Dr. Gary Steven. He's an allergist and immunologist. Do you have trouble distinguishing whether you have a cold or an allergy? Did you move to a different home or a different part of the country? Did that affect your allergies? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Steven, can you tell us about how histamines work and what's happening in our body physiologically with histamines?
Histamine is a chemical that is stored by cells in the body called mast cells that gets released in an allergic reaction. So the development of allergic antibodies is a random genetic event. We all have some level of allergic antibodies in our system. Most of them don't do much, but for those of us who are making allergic antibodies against these common allergens to which we are then exposed, that interaction, inhaling that allergen, having it bind to that allergic antibody, that then causes a release of histamine, which causes all of the symptoms that we associate with allergies. It causes the itching, the watery nose, the sneezing, the scratchy throat, And when severe, when there is a massive release of histamine, such as in food allergy and stinging insect allergy and antibiotic allergy, this massive histamine release and causes a drop in blood pressure and an increase in heart rate that we call anaphylaxis.
Are there any links between stress and allergies?
There's a lot of the links between stress and allergies. We do see an increased tendency in developing allergies in people who are under chronic stress. But for the most part, the interaction is between the nervous system and the immune system is that immune reactions, allergic reactions, are going to be to feel augmented when people are stressed. So so for a given level of allergic symptoms, people who are undergoing chronic physical or mental stress are definitely going to feel their allergy symptoms much more acutely.
So stress can also lead to more histamine in your bloodstream?
Not necessarily directly to histamine. It is the way the person perceives the consequences of the histamine. You're not going to, if you're making allergic antibody, you have the ability to release histamine when exposed to that allergen. Stress doesn't affect that.
Okay.
But stress is going to affect your response to that allergen.
We've seen some research out there that found that infants who are born via C-section had an impact on their likelihood to develop allergies later in life. Anything to that?
Yes, there's a massive body of evidence that's been accumulated over the last 10, 15 years, and that's been referred to traditionally as the hygiene hypothesis. Now we're speaking of it more in terms of the microbiome. And we really have very convincing evidence now that the normal functioning of the immune system has developed because of the way we interact with bacteria in our environment. The hygiene hypothesis was first described from the observation that people in rural areas and in third world countries have far less allergy and asthma than people in developed countries and in urban environments. And to make a long story short, it is very clear that is because the people growing up on the farm and living in third world countries eat dirt, and they expose their immune system to the types of bacteria that are needed for the normal development of the immune system.
Pausing right there. Allergy season has arrived. We're with allergist Gary Steven, who is our guide. You can join in 800-642-1234. What are your questions about seasonal allergies, food allergies, allergy diagnosis? Let's talk about it back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're getting the lowdown on allergy season, how to cope with it. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Allergy Organization says 400 million people worldwide get hay fever, which includes illnesses caused by indoor and outdoor airborne allergens. We're talking about how to get a handle on allergies. Join in with your questions, your tips, 800-642-1234. Have you noticed your allergies getting worse over time? Do you use an over-the-counter medication? What about immunotherapy, getting shots that can help desensitize your immune system to an allergen? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Allergist and immunologist Gary Steven is fielding our questions. Dr. Steven, as we were talking about infants there, how can you tell if your infant or your young child has asthma or allergies? What does that process look like to a diagnosis?
The typical development of allergic problems in a young child starts off with eczema. They get rashes as an infant, and as they get older, they get into age 3, 4, 5. They develop allergic rhinitis with increasing nasal congestion, sneezing. And as they get older, 8, 9, 10 years old, they develop asthma. That's what's referred to as the allergic march. That's the textbook definition of the development of allergies. A lot of kids don't follow that progression. They'll develop allergies as a young child, sometimes not until their teen years, with nasal congestion and sneezing without ever having any rashes or eczema. Some people develop asthma without overt signs of nasal allergies, but that is a lot less common. Most people develop nasal symptoms either prior to or with the development of breathing problems, the wheezing, the coughing with exertion, such as playing sports. Especially waking up in the middle of the night and you're short of breath, coughing, wheezing, none of these things are normal, and all of these things need to be addressed. And we do see some complications now in people in their 40s and 50s. It was much more common years ago to tolerate some symptoms. Your parents would just say that, you got a little trouble breathing, deal with it. But the problem with that and what we're seeing now is that there is significant allergic inflammation in the nose and sinuses when these symptoms develop in young people. And that inflammation, if left unchecked over years or decades, leads to significant permanent changes like scar tissue type things in the sinuses and lungs. So it's really important that young children who are exhibiting these symptoms, a lot of nasal congestion and sneezing, especially those that are so stuffy they can't breathe through the nose when they're sleeping, if people are limiting their activities because of their breathing, they get short of breath and start to wheeze or cough with exertion. And this is not something that you should be accommodating. It is something that you should be getting evaluated, getting a diagnosis, and avoiding relevant allergens and getting that inflammation addressed.
Amanda from Beaver Dam called in to ask why so many people seem to have food allergies. Her son has food allergies, really bad, she says, and neither she nor her husband have food allergies. She wants to know how that can be. How does that develop?
Food allergies is like any other allergy, is a genetic thing. But the development of allergic antibodies is due to a complex recombination of DNA and the development of cells of the immune system called lymphocytes. And so it is based on these certain gene sequences being present in a family. So while the tendency to develop allergies is genetic, you do tend to see it running in families, it does not necessarily affect every family member. The two issues with the food allergies, one, they are becoming more common, and that is related to the hygiene hypothesis we've discussed before. And secondly, we're paying more attention to them, like I was just talking about with allergic rhinitis and asthma. People don't put up with it anymore. Years ago, if you had trouble with the food, they'd just say, well, don't eat the food, and they left it at that. We're more interested in getting these sensitivities addressed, and primarily because they are becoming more significant. It's one of the little things that I do now is that stemming from the hygiene hypothesis is when I walk into a room with a new patient who's a child, the first thing I do is I look at the mom's hands, and if I see you know, the vague your redness, the contact dermatitis from, you know, having her hands in Lysol and bleach for most of the day, sterilizing the home environment. I know this is going to be an allergic kid because their immune system has not developed normally. Now I'm not telling the caller in Beaver Dam that her kid is allergic because she used Lysol. Don't take it that way. But we are seeing this trend that for increasing food allergies, due in large part to the hygiene hypothesis, due in large part to our decreasing tolerance for just putting up with it and being more proactive about it.
Well, let's go to Travis now in Mercer. Hi, Travis.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Yeah, I had a question. I actually had allergies from like early elementary school all the way through middle school, and I started off getting shots.
Oh, Travis, we're having a difficult time. Are you still there? Like, carry on? Yeah.
And then I eventually the shots didn't work and nose sprays didn't work, and I did some kind of drop that went underneath my tongue. And they weren't very potent at first, and then they were real strong, and then they kind of weaned me off of them. And ever since then, I don't have any allergies. But I don't really know what they were or anything about them. I was just wondering if you had any information about that.
Travis, thanks. So it sounds like he was on the drops.
Yeah, there's lots of things that go on with that. It's kind of impossible to tell, you know, without knowing what the test results were, what the symptoms were. Even if over a period of time he was really being treated to the same types of things, you know, as a child and adolescent versus as an adult, the manifestations of allergies are not as simple as what they necessarily appear. That's why we do testing, because if we could figure out what was going on just by talking with somebody, then we wouldn't bother to do the tests. But it does get very complicated, and so for the number one reason for good allergy medication to not work is that they're not being used to treat allergies. There's lots of things that appear to be allergies. There are lots of things that people describe as an allergy. Pretty much anything that happens to us that we think is due to something in the environment or something that we ate, we call it an allergy. We throw that term around, but a lot of the symptoms that people have that they call an allergy are not. And so it depends on the interpretation and what's really going on.
Dr. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Gary Stephen is an allergist and immunologist at the Allergy, Asthma, and Sinus Center in Greenfield. We've been getting tips on how to handle the spring allergy season. Coming up, Republicans on the state's budget writing committee met last week and laid out plans to eliminate some of Governor Evers' signature proposals out of the state budget. We'll look at the budget stalemate on the state capitol report. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.